Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where on the planet you are. This is Eric Rubenstein. I am Advise Health's Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support. This is Season 1, Episode 2 of Retro Fraud. And I'm here today with a good friend of mine, another former retired OIG agent, Wade McFowell. Wade was a special agent in our LA field office around the same time that I was. Then got promoted to assistant special agent in charge in that same office, which meant that he went from investigating fraud, waste, abuse cases, criminal, civil, and administrative, over to supervising a squad or a group of agents that were involved in the day-to-day. As part of Wade's responsibilities, he supervised agents working the cases, interacted with a bunch of the prosecutor's offices that were out there, also as well as myself doing protection and security details. Wade got to travel the world a little bit as part of being on the secretary's sort of extended protection detail. Wade retired and then went into doing some work for the iMedic, which is one of the contractors for CMS that does benefit integrity, retired from there, and does a lot of work with us here at Advise. He's currently titled as our director of special projects and operations and helps us with process management and things on some of the SIU work that I do. So I want to introduce Wade. Wade, did I miss anything?
You got it.
All right. Very good. So Wade and I were talking yesterday about, you know, how we were going to do this. This presentation, this discussion today, and the case that Wade's going to talk about is something that involves organized crime from the perspective of check diversion and really the heart of where the finances of the Medicare program frauds are, which is, you know, it's ultimately getting that money. So Wade, I'm going to turn it over to you, and then, you know, we'll have a little bit of a back and forth about it, but why don't you give us sort of an overview of what the issue was that you guys were looking at?
Okay. So we were contacted by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, when they came across a situation involving Medicare that they were kind of unfamiliar with. So what happened was they had an informant who was working with their agents on a number of things unrelated to Medicare, but he came across some people who brought him a batch of checks. And it was a dozen or so checks totaling $50,000 or $60,000. And they knew that he had somebody in the banking industry that he was working with. And they basically needed him to launder these checks. And the ICE agents weren't really sure what was going on with this. So we looked into it. And the checks were Medicare checks that were cut to various physicians. Some of them who were on our radar because they were billing for beneficiaries who were on patient lists. So they were basically capped beneficiaries or beneficiaries who we knew they were on a list because they were overutilized and they, in most likeliness, were taking money for going to clinics for services that they didn't need. They were basically getting paid to go to a doctor and they would get things like orthotics and stuff they didn't need, but Medicare was paid for them. So a lot of the doctors were on our radar, and there were some that were new to us and we didn't know about, but at any rate, we knew these checks were likely for fraudulent claims. So we started working with them and with their CI, their confidential informant. And basically we laundered the checks, we cashed them and returned the money to the bad guys in some cases. In some cases we would note the checks, like take photocopies and return them to them and say we couldn't do it, just so that we would see how they would do it if not for us. They had other avenues that they would launder the checks. So
if I can, I just want to interrupt. So let's talk about a couple of things that you brought up. So the first thing you brought up is this concept of laundering. And so some of the people that are going to be listening to this podcast or watching this podcast are people who may not understand what the term laundering is or really what the process is. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. Well, the checks are, so let's say it's made out to you. The check is made to Eric's name. but Eric is not cashing it. So they need an avenue to turn this fraudulent check into cash, basically. And if I was to take a check in your name to the bank, I don't have your ID. I don't have, you know, I'm not the account holder. I can't cash the check. So you need somebody really on the inside to do that. You need a bank employee or somebody who's going to bend the rules in order to turn that check into cash. So that's really a very stripped down version of laundering. Sure. But if it's a legitimate check, you don't need to launder because you have an ID and you can go to your bank and you can deposit it or cash it. But if I have a check that's made out to you or Dr. whoever, I can't cash it because I don't have the means to do that. So I need a launderer to do that.
So it's basically a manner of taking some illicit proceeds and moving that illicit proceeds into a form that then becomes usable, because the proceeds by themselves you wouldn't be able to do anything with, like, you know, a check made out to me that you've stolen or done something with. You can't do anything with it because it's my check. So you need somebody to help you with getting that check converted into currency, into cash. So laundering is essentially the process by which illicit funds are converted into a manner for appropriate to spend for use. The other term that you use, I want to talk a little about is capper, which sometimes has a little bit of different definitions. So in the sort of the no-fault world, the term capper is often used for the middleman, the person who, or the runner. Sometimes a capper or runner is sort of that middleman. And that's the person in like a no-fault case that sets up the, you know, the staged accident with the clinic, or, you know, sort of that middleman. And I think for your purposes, the capper in your instances are the beneficiaries that were involved with the fraud taking the kickbacks, or is capper a similar definition?
Well, it's not necessarily the beneficiaries, but it is the middleman, and it's somebody who works for a clinic, and they basically go, a lot of times they'll go door to door, but they're basically approaching Medicare beneficiaries and offering them something, usually cash, but sometimes it's just, they can either give them, you know, $100, or they can say, look, if you go to this doctor, we'll take you to our doctor, and we'll either give you cash, or we'll take you, and in exchange for going, you'll get these orthotics, you'll get these knee braces, you'll get maybe an electric wheelchair, a back brace, a big scheme years ago was a thoracic lumbar sacral orthoses body jackets. And I wouldn't necessarily want one of those, but a lot of people, the beneficiaries, they went just because they told they could get one for free.
For free. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I remember when I first started OIG, one of the first projects I worked on was something similar in Brooklyn. And it was with in a community in Brooklyn known as Brighton Beach, which is a very heavy, heavy Russian community. And I understand that this case actually dealt with people that were from, they were Armenian. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, you're not talking about the same country, but you're talking about similar regions of the country, I think. And so I think part of the thing that fascinates me is that to an extent, a lot of these fraud schemes percolate through cultural groups across the country. And similarly, the cases that we worked in Brooklyn, this is way before the healthcare strike forces were in play, we would go out and do interviews of beneficiaries, and they loved Angora, these very old Russian immigrants who came over. You know, my grandparents are from Russia, so I'm sitting with these people. I'm like, well, this is like, it's like sitting and talking to my grandmother or my grandfather. And the big thing was Angora. I don't know why, but there was this attraction to Angora. And so we would go to these beneficiaries' homes to interview them, and they were termed M beneficiaries. You remember, right at the end. So, you know, at the end of your Medicare number, the old days before it was known as the Medicare beneficiary identifier, the MBI, your Medicare number was typically your Social Security number with the letter A at the end, or the primary was A, the secondary was B, if you didn't have enough employment to get social benefits of Medicare and Social Security. But then there were these M beneficiaries, which were people who became eligible for Medicare who hadn't paid into it because of their immigration status. You know, you have these very old people that came from Russia who there was no way they could do the 40 quarters. And so they would be the ones that were preyed upon. And it was very similar. But, you know, I remember going to these people's homes and they would say, well, I got all of this stuff. And you'd open up like a closet door and there'd be a closet full of Angora sweaters and Angora socks and jackets. And I'll never forget, you know, one where the woman, she had to have been about 1,000 years old. And she was so proud of a television that she got. And she showed me the TV. It was in her kitchen. You know, she's in this very tiny apartment. And you know, it was really almost like a one room apartment. And she's got this very, very tiny kitchen. And there's a little like tray table, you know, TV type tray table. And that's where she eats. And next to it on the counter was this television. And I'm walking in like, she's like, I want to show you this very heavy Russian accent. And it was really reminiscent of my grandmother. My grandmother had a very heavy Russian accent. And I remember walking in the kitchen and like thinking I'm going to see this, you know, oh my God, this is this TV she got. And it was a 12 inch black and white TV where for, you know, for the kids out there that don't know it, but you had to change the channel, you know, it had channels 2 through 13. And, you know, as a kid, I had one of those. And the way you change the remote control was me, right, getting up to change the channel. So she had this little 12 inch black and white TV on her kitchen counter. And it had aluminum foil, or for older people who call it tin foil, on the rabbit ears, which was the antenna. And she was, you know, it barely got the channels. I mean, we're right in New York City, you know, all the channels should be coming in. And, you know, she was so proud of this TV because back in Russia, that was what only the wealthy people had. And so getting things like Angora and these TVs, you know, sort of made people feel, I think, special. But really, at the end of the day, they were nothing more than being trafficked, right? They're just being brokered. Even, you know, later on, we worked cases later on where people were being paid $25 and they would go and get physical therapy 3 times a week for things that they didn't need. So it sounds like it's very, very reminiscent of similar pattern.
Yeah, it was either, in most cases it was cash, but a lot of times they, you know, if they could give them some type of durable medical equipment that Medicare paid for and give it to them for free, and that was the key thing. It's like, why did you give them your information? You know, they're going to bill for various things that you don't even know about. And a lot of times they knew that, a lot of times they didn't. But if they were getting something for free, that's all it took, and they would hand over their Medicare card and their ID. That simple.
So the reimbursements then come into the illicit clinics. They come in at the time. This is going back to about 2010 or so, right? It's paper check. So CMS, the rule changed in 2011 or 2012, requiring that all reimbursements come in through something called EFT, electronic funds transfer. But at the time, it was paper checks that were physically being mailed. And so if you had somebody at the clinic who was part and parcel to the fraud, or if the clinic was entirely fraudulently based, getting these checks was relatively easy. And then it was just a matter of having someone that worked with your illicit clinic to then cash the checks, right?
Right. And so what would happen too, before this case, we were kind of seeing this kind of scheme unfold, but one of the early kind of indicators of this process was we had doctors coming to us, coming to the OIG and saying, look, I got a 1099 for, or W-2, 1099, I guess, for a clinic that I have never heard of. I don't know about it. It's an address I'm not aware of. And according to this 1099, I made $6 million or whatever, millions of dollars at this clinic. And now I owe taxes on it. And a lot of times the doctors would have gone to the address. They did some research and it's either a vacant, you know, strip mall, or there was one a doctor that came to us and he went to the location and it was in downtown LA in the garment district, and it was on like the 8th floor of this building, and I went to check it out, and the number one, the elevator was broken, so I had to go up 8 floors of stairs. The 7 floors below it were all people just sewing clothes, and on the the roof of this building was supposedly this clinic where he was prescribing wheelchairs for all his patients. It's like eighth floor of a building with no working elevator. And then we're getting
wheelchairs.
So he was
so in the world of investigations, we would call that a clue. And in the OIG world, we would say that doesn't pass the stink test. So, it's similar to when you go and I had a guy that I mentored when a bunch of years ago, and it was an ambulance case. And we show up at the house to go interview someone at the house, and they're supposed to be, they need dialysis three times a week and they need to go by stretcher. We get to the house and the house is on top of a hill and it's probably 300 or 400 stairs. And there's no ramp, there's nothing. And we get out of the car and I look at the new guy and I say to him, okay, this is an ambulance case, dialysis three times a week by stretcher. When you look at this house, what's the first thing that kind of gets you? And you kind of scratch your head and you go, well, that's a clue. And then you get to the top of the stairs and there is a wheelchair, but the wheelchair is outside of the house. You're like, well, the wheelchair's outside of the house. We would call that a clue. And those certainly don't pass the OIG stink test.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot
So you're able to confirm that a lot of these clinics are are either non-existent or minimally operational or something like that. And you've got a cooperating witness, you called it a CI, which is also known as a cooperating informant or something along those lines. And that person is handling the movement of the check from illicit funds received to cash to then be used as the proceeds of the fraud, right? So in the world of money laundering, in order to charge money laundering, you need what's known as that specified unlawful activity, because just the cashing of a check wouldn't be, and healthcare fraud is one of them. So they call that the predicate offense. So the predicate offense in this is that the check is made up of fraudulent activity. Then you've got your confidential informant that's doing that. Were there any instances where you were able to, where the confidential informant, were there recordings, were there instances? I mean, this guy's not just grabbing checks and going depositing them, right? He needs to be able to have conversations to put a story behind the fraud.
Yeah. So they brought the informant checks in batches of like, a dozen or so checks at a time, totaling between like $50,000 and $80,000. So he'd bring the checks and we would basically take them and we would cash them through an undercover account that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, had that they used for other investigations unrelated to Medicare, mostly trafficking and import export kind of cases. So we kind of had an idea of what was going on, but we had a couple of recordings where it became very clear, because our informant was pretty good at trying to draw information out of them for our recordings. We tell them what we want, we would need specific information. So there was one specific meeting where one of the subjects basically told them, we were cashing checks, and at one point we had an issue with the account. So we said, hey, we can probably still cash these, but it's going to take some time. And they got like upset about that. They wanted their money, but he basically told our subject or our informant, look, we get the doctor. I don't want to quote exactly, but he basically said, we control him at this clinic. We know about, we work with him there. We have people that work with him. We get the information, but then we get this other one. We do a change of address. We open a new clinic and he says, it's best if he doesn't know about it. So we get a new clinic. We still control him at the one clinic. At the other clinic, we can control him because he doesn't know about it. And when the OIG comes knocking at the door to ask questions, he can't say anything about it because he doesn't know anything.
No.
Did
you guys use the term doc in the box? That was something that we would use on the East Coast, is a doctor who was just sort of there as the figurehead. but didn't really control the operation. We would just call them a doc in a box, where the control came out of a management company or some other person. He was just sort of the, and sometimes they call it the nominee or the straw owner.
Yeah, we had the same situation. We didn't use doc in the box. I've heard it. We haven't used that as much, but for sure straw owners, where it's a doctor that's, he's basically signing charts and, signing off on stuff.
Right. Totally
medically unnecessary. You know, he's all but in on all the fraud. He's just signing off on stuff.
So I just put this graphic up real quick while we're talking, because I think it's always great to show a graphic of what a scheme is, if we can talk about that. And this is sort of what your typical money laundering scheme is, right? This is just off of the web, right? So the collection of the dirty money in this instance is the receipt of the illicit funds in the form of a Medicare check. And then the placement is taking that money and putting it into the system, meaning finding your helper to help you move the money from a check into the bank. And then whether it be layering, meaning moving it around. In this case, it sounds like the layering piece wasn't really prevalent. They just, because they had somebody on the inside to move that money, but they did create some other accounts. So there was some limited layering of the funds. And then obviously then it pulling that money out and then, you know, using it to buy things, because that's ultimately what these guys are looking to do. So this is what a typical scheme would look like. And it sounds like what you just described is really what the playbook of money laundering winds up being. And so to me, this really gets to the heart of where we talk about retro fraud, is that the money laundering process has never really changed. It's always been the same. So you've got your confidential informant and he's out there doing, and you know, were there ever any instances where the confidential informant ran into any snags, or you guys had any, were there any safety issues? Because you're obviously dealing with a confidential informant. You're dealing with some guys who are probably not the friendliest of sorts, right? Because there's a lot of money at stake, and the healthcare fraud conglomerates are pretty big, and there's a lot of money involved. Were there any things that came up that were safety concern related?
Yeah, there was a couple different instances where the informant met with the subjects at his residence. So of course we would have a lot of agents on scene. We'd have probably like five different vehicles with at least one agent in each car. So you may have 10 or a dozen agents there for safety reasons. And they would often have people that came with what we would consider counter surveillance. We were surveilling the meeting and they were surveilling us. So I would have like six cars within the vicinity, within a block or two of the residence. And they had people that came out and were shining flashlights in cars, parked cars, basically looking for us. So we would have to, duck down and keep mobile, keep moving, so they couldn't find us. But they definitely had counter surveillance. And in one incident where they did have counter surveillance, we had a situation where they brought our informant checks to launder, but they weren't endorsed yet by the doctor. So we had been in his residence, and we set up cameras and video and audio recording devices. So they had the initial meeting, and they kept wanting to take him outside. They were very tech savvy. They knew that that's one way to, you move the meeting to avoid in case there's any video or audio recording. So they kept taking him outside to talk to him. So we were missing part of the meetings because we had our camera set up inside his house. So when they took the checks to get them endorsed supposedly by the doctor, and this was at like midnight or 11:30, late at night, you're not gonna go find a doctor to endorse your checks, your legitimate checks at midnight. So they left the premises. So we went into the house, myself and a tech agent, an agent who was advanced at video and audio surveillance. So we went in to move the cameras so that we could get the, if they kept going outside, we could get the video. And as we, as I drove up to the house, he went in the house to move it, and they came back like 10 minutes later. They didn't go to find the doctor. They went around the corner and signed the checks that came back. So I had to pull off because I was parked in front of the house in a government, you know, vehicle. So my agent on the inside, I had him on the phone. I said, I got to pull off. They're coming back. You got to hide, basically get in the closet, whatever. So he went in the closet, kept his phone open so I could have like a communication. I could hear what was going on. But he was in the house for maybe in another hour or so, close to an hour. And there was no way around it. I mean, we knew that these guys were always armed. They had bulletproof vests. And so I'm like just outside the house, and I have an agent who's in the house with them, and he's obviously armed and very well trained. I didn't have concerns, you know. I was hoping they wouldn't find him, but it was it got a little bit, you know, got a little bit hairy there for a while.
And at any point when this all came to fruition and you were able to, you know, arrest, I'm assuming arrests were made of the actors involved with the clinics. Did you guys get to do any search warrants of the residences or offices of the defendants in this case, the targets?
We did, and it was mostly, might have been all, it was generally homes, not offices, but we did search warrants when we did arrests, and we found lots of weapons. You know, a lot of people sometimes, you know, they, if they're not familiar with what the OIG does, they're like, why do you guys, you know, have these automatic weapons and vests and, you know, Kevlar and all this stuff? You go into houses like this, and we have seized dozens. In this case alone, we probably seized, I don't know, two or three dozen weapons. And we're talking like between, you know, handguns, concealable handguns to full-on military, you know, M4, semi-automatic. I mean, they have all kinds of weapons all the time. That's why we kind of have to go that route of being better safe than sorry. We go in on search warrants. We go in just like it's a drug raid. I mean, because you don't, in many cases, they're well armed. And I think OIG's been very fortunate. I don't think we've really had any injuries, like agents being shot or anything like that. But you go into these residences, and they're into all kinds of stuff. So it's very important.
Yeah. That's true. And I'll tell you, you know, I'm very prolific on LinkedIn. I do a lot of posts. I'm obviously a very big supporter of the OIG. It was my home for a very long time. It's, you know, it gave me a livelihood for a long time. And oftentimes when you see articles published online, there's always a picture of a news article. There'll be a picture. And oftentimes those pictures are pictures of OIG agents getting ready to execute a search warrant or an arrest warrant. You know, it's some sort of stock. A number of years ago, you remember on CNBC, there was a one-hour documentary done called The Healthcare Hustle. It focused on actually my region, Region 2. It was predominantly in Puerto Rico and in Brooklyn. I think it was all in Brooklyn. Our agents from Puerto Rico came up. And the issue that I often am faced with in having discussions with people is, well, you were an OIG agent for HHS. You're doing healthcare. Why do you need all that equipment? And I think the thing I always have to try to impart in people is that the world is not what people think it is. You know, I've had instances with doctors who I'm sitting there talking to them. They're behind their desk. Their hands are on the desk because they're just talking to me. But, you know, the desk drawer is half open and there's a gun sitting in the desk drawer, you know, or something like that. And, you know, part of it is you don't know who you're interacting with. You go to a business and you don't know who all of the employees are. You know, people act in strange ways and you just don't understand it. In the consulting world now, you know, I oftentimes help with some compliance stuff. And one of the things I always talk about is, do you have some policies on how you're going to deal with law enforcement? And, you know, the thing that people always say is, well, you know, there was a search warrant and they all had guns and they had vests and they had this and, you know, their guns were out. And I said, well, guns were on, they're not always out, but, you know, this is it. You know, these are law enforcement events and you're taking people's liberty, and, you know, in some instances. And so that's what you're talking about is a very good representative example, because you don't know. I know, you know, a couple of years before I retired, we did a search warrant in New Jersey, and the people were previously convicted felons. They couldn't have firearms. They had altered assault rifles and, you know, again, similar, dozens of guns, handguns, assault rifles and the like. And so, you know, the world of healthcare fraud is not what I think people necessarily perceive. So how many at the end, how many defendants in that case, if you remember, how many wound up getting prosecuted?
I think there was seven defendants all together. And it was interesting too, because I interviewed a couple of them. One of them specifically, I remember when we arrested him, we did a payoff. We paid, I think it was $5,000 in checks that we laundered. We gave him $75,000 in cash. We obviously photocopied all the bills, so we had the serial numbers, that type of thing. And then we put it in a FedEx box, and we did like a, it was kind of cool. We did like a invisible marker that you could only see if you shined a black light on it. Mm-hmm. So we paid him with this box of cash. And then we had the sheriff's department basically follow them and wait for PC to pull them over. And he did a legal lane change. They pulled him over. They found the box of cash. You're like, what's this cash for? And he had some story that was obviously not very good. And so they arrested him. And I go and interview him in the jail. And he was one of the lower players. He wasn't like the kingpin. He was like a worker. Mm-hmm. But he was, you know, it's the typical, you've done this many times. You're like, look, you're looking at X amount of months you're going to be in prison. Talk to me about, you know, who you're bringing the money to, trying to get more information. And he was not having it. He didn't give us anything. He's like, I'm going away for whatever you're going to put me away for. He wouldn't talk, wouldn't give us information. So it was interesting that, you know, you try and work your way up the hill, go to the who you're working for, get to the top of the chain of command there. He wasn't having it. He went away for, I think, 3 years or something. We never get as many months as we want on these cases.
That's true.
Depending on what you're going to charge, you know, we try to charge money laundering or identity theft gives you a little bit bigger of a hammer. Some of them ended up for another whole podcast worth of reasons, but a lot of them, it was just a 1347 healthcare fraud scheme, mm-hmm. as opposed to money laundering, which carries a bigger hammer. But
right.
To go back to your question, there was about seven or eight, I think it was seven defendants that were ultimately charged and all did varying amounts of time.
And how much money?
There was, as far as restitution, there was none.
Well, so there's always a difference, but how much money did you guys calculate was the fraud, and then how much was restitution? Because those numbers are typically wildly different for the purposes of negotiating a resolution to the matter.
Yeah, I think we came up with somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 some, early 20 millions as far as the like projected loss amount. The actual the number of or the total of the checks that we actually received was right around $7 million. And of that, some of it we processed and paid cash back. Some of it we just returned the checks so we could follow how they cashed them. If not for us, there are other laundering opportunities. But it was in the $20 million range.
And there's always going to be money that's never going to be accounted for, because, you know, you only know what you know. So what's interesting about what makes this a great retro fraud discussion is that there are some schemes going on now which have capitalized on the fact that the system is done through an EFT. So the crooks are getting a hold of the information needed to do essentially a change of address, but do it as a change of EFT. So the scheme is the same, right? So the fraud is still occurring, but instead of the money being put into an illicit paper check, it's just being done through an electronic funds transfer, you know, a wire transfer from point A to point B. So the fraud schemes are, you know, again, it's a different, it's the same circus, but it's just different clowns. It's the same sort of fraud scheme. And, you know, I think what it's not like someone suddenly decided, hey, we need to change this up. They just modernize, right? So they say, here's the scheme. The scheme is we were doing this illicitly with checks, but now when you're not doing it with the checks, you no longer need that middleman because you've created the bogus through the identity theft. You've created the bogus accounts. You've created the bogus method and, you know, means by which you can do it. And then it's just a matter of sending out these EFT forms, these change forms, and getting someone willing to bite at your apple. And then again, the identity theft thing becomes even more prevalent now, because now we're seeing healthcare conglomerates, you know, insurance companies, payers, banks, everybody, these breaches, right? So identities are all out on the deep web. You know, one of the impetuses, obviously, for the MBI was because the Medicare ID was a social security number, and it was nearly impossible. You know, they had the list of compromised, the compromised Benny numbers, they used to call that. But at the end of the day, that was really just for the purposes of maybe monitoring, whereas the MBI has the ability to, you know, if that number's been compromised, you can theoretically, just like a credit card, get it, get it shut off. And, you know, one of the things that I would like to see is similar to a credit card. I can go online, and if my credit card has been compromised, I could shut that bad boy off. There should be a way to be able to do that at some point with something like an MBI, where, you know, I think not this generation of Medicare beneficiaries, I think future generations who are more tech savvy are going to be able to, you know, with those kind of things are going to be utilized. But this was a great one because it really does show that the fraud scheme of 2010, 2011, you know, it's now 11, 12 years later, and it's the same thing. It's the usurping of an MPI number for the purposes of fraudulent billing, or the doc in the box for fraudulent billing. It's moving from paper checks to electronic. It's the paying of beneficiaries in return for the use of their now MBI, formerly the HIC, the health insurance claim number. So it's sort of the same thing. I'm sure that we could probably talk about 20 years, you know, because we were both there a long time. We could probably talk about 20 years worth of cases and still find today press releases that still talk about the fraud schemes in exactly the same manner. It's just it's almost plug and play, right? I mean, unless there's a new code or something new, but the recycling of the fraud schemes is pretty much, you know, a similar thing.
And it's interesting you bring that up, because when we were working this case, we had a Title III, basically a wiretap, and so we're listening to their conversations on their phones without them knowing. And a lot of conversations came up, although most of them had to be translated. But there was conversation about finding more doctors that were still on paper checks, because that was the time frame when CMS to go to EFT. And they, I guess, in hindsight, they really hadn't figured out how to take this scheme that we talk about with laundering the checks and converting that into being able to launder through electronic fund transfer. So right. This was at the time when we were advancing, Medicare was advancing to like a new system, and the crooks were not yet there as far as how to transfer this system of laundering their funds from paper checks to electronic.
So it's interesting, you talked about, so Title III is the legal parlance for doing what's known as a wiretap. And a wiretap is essentially when you're listening in on communications in which none of the parties are consenting, right? So different state laws allow for different levels of consent. So for example, when I'm in New Jersey, New Jersey is what they call a one-party consent state, which means if I want to record a conversation with you, I don't need to request permission from you to do that. If I'm sitting in New Jersey, I can just turn on my recording device and I can do it. Florida is what they call a two-party consent state. So when I'm sitting in Florida, I need to get your approval to do it, you know, on both ends. But a Title III is essentially that none of the parties are consenting, and that requires a court order from a judge. And there's some very specific requirements for doing that, where you're listening in. And then in this case, you had to have all of those conversations translated. And then, so, you know, one of the things that comes up in a lot of conversations, sort of as closing, I want to wrap up with a couple of quick points, but the one thing that comes up often in conversations is, why do these cases take so long to be investigated and prosecuted? And so it sounds like a couple of the things that wind up taking time are, first of all, if you're listening to these conversations, they need to be translated, a transcript needs to be created. So that puts a time lag on, right? And then the checks themselves, once they've been laundered, getting the check takes a little bit of time. I know that, you know, if we were to do a subpoena to a bank to get checks, that subpoena then sits in a queue with all the other subpoenas going to the bank. And that could be sometimes months before you get a response. And so getting the check from the payer, which in this case would have been the carrier or the MAC, but there's still a delay. And so, you know, I presume obviously that none of this is real time. Gathering information outside of the act of the crime being committed is not in real time. So I presume that those were some of the things that triggered some delays in being able to expeditiously do this. Because people will say, well, it's a $20 million fraud. How is it that you couldn't just stop it?
Right. Yeah, two things that you mentioned there. One is the transcripts of the conversation. So we had the Title III on a varying number of phone lines. So in most cases, we had like seven main subjects. So there was at least seven phones that we were monitoring all the time. So we had people in the monitoring room 24 hours a day, because these guys worked through the night a lot of times. So we had like four people who were on 24 hours or four positions 24 hours a day. Most of it was in a foreign language. So we had to not only transcribe, but translate all that stuff. There's other rules, not to get too far in the weeds, but like if you're monitoring a conversation and they're talking about, you know, my son's basketball game or something, and it's not related to the fraud, you have to, they call it minimize. So we have to stop listening for a specific time period. I think it was 2 minutes or something like that. And then you can go back to see if they're talking about the fraud or if they're still talking about the basketball game. So you get these long recordings, you know, think about how much time you're on your phone every day. All that stuff has to be transcribed. Anything that's not minimized has to be transcribed. So that takes forever. The checks, like you say, typically if the OIG sends out a subpoena for a check from a bank, you have a willing, you know, they typically are cooperating, but you give them 30 days, I think 30 or 60 days to respond. And almost always they're going to ask for an extension. So there's another 30 or 60 days and then you get the check. So it's a very time consuming, you know, effort to get all the documentation you needed. Then once you have it, you still have to build your case working with the U.S. attorney. It's like, this is our legal theory and what the fraud is, what the violation is, the actual law that's being broken. And then you have to basically get, even if you don't think you're going to go to trial, you get trial ready. You know, we have to prove this in front of a bunch of jurors. So these cases take 5, 6, 7, sometimes 8 or 10 years to work.
Right. Right. No. And I think that's an important point, because I think sometimes people who don't work in this space or didn't do this for a living sometimes are missing a piece of that puzzle. And it's good to always put that color into to get people to understand where some of those time lags are. And the fact that you can't stop the bleeding sometimes until you're ready to sever the limb, so to speak.
Right.
So, yeah, look, this sounds like it was a great case. I think this really fits in well with the fact that this was an old fraud, but it really is just a recycling. It really is the playbook. Press releases that come out on good fraud prosecutions are always interesting to read, but at the same time, they also become the novel by which people looking to get into fraud can then say, oh, well, this worked for all of these years. Maybe if I just did it for, instead of 7 years, maybe if I did it for five, I wouldn't get caught, you know, or what have you. So, well, listen, Wade, we're going to wrap up. We're just about out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending some of the time and talking about this case. It really is an interesting one. All of them, we could probably do this. You know, we have each 20 years worth of stories. We can probably go back and forth and tell tales of cases that occurred on different sides of the country. But we're all fairly reminiscent of each other, whether it be the fact pattern or, you know, or pieces of the scheme, whether it be the same cultural group or what have you. So I look forward to having you on again in the future. Thanks everybody for tuning in. Again, this is part of Advise Health's free podcast that we're doing. The content is all up on our Advise You. Feel free to surf around and check out some of the other retro fraud podcasts that I've done previously. And we look forward to hearing from you about suggestions for other ones that we might do in the future. Take care, everybody.